This Week in Retronauts, Memoirs of a Game Counselor. One of the most challenging things about Retronauts is that Bob and I just didn't have the means to play every classic game back in the day. The show involves a lot of research as a result. Of course, when we were kids, we didn't have Gamefly, the best way to buy and rent all your favorite games. With a monthly subscription to Gamefly.com, you can pick your favorite games from more than 9,000 titles and have them mailed directly to your door to try before you buy. You don't have to waste your money buying the latest new games until you know if they're worth it. For one monthly fee, Gamefly gives you access to unlimited video game rentals of all the most popular titles, from mainstream favorites like Madden and Call of Duty to dense JRPGs like Octopath Traveler. A subscription costs as little as 54 cents a day. There's always free shipping on the more than 9,000 titles available, and you can cancel anytime. You can keep your rentals as long as you want to, with no late fees or due dates. Just mail back a game once you're done, and they'll send you whatever you choose next. And they offer movie rentals, too. Go to Gamefly.com/retronauts and start your free premium 30-day trial today. This premium trial allows you to check out two games and or movies at a time. A special Retronauts offer. The usual first free month offer is only one game at a time. You can only get this offer by visiting Gamefly.com/retronauts. Sign up today and start playing all your favorite games absolutely free for 30 days. Everyone, welcome to another episode of Retronauts. This is another live on-site in Japan episode. I am Jeremy Parrish, and I am in sunny, humid Kyoto, Japan once again, adjacent to Bit Summit. And this time I am at the offices of 17-Bit to talk to the man, the legend.
Jake Kasdahl. Hi, how are you doing, everybody?
Yeah. Jake, it's great to have you on the show. I can't believe we haven't actually had you on Retronauts until now. But yeah, we've known each other for ages, and I've gradually discovered that you have all kinds of fascinating anecdotes about having worked in the video games industry for a long, long time. When did you start working in the games industry?
1989.
How? Do you mind saying how old you were at that point? You must have been a teenager.
I had just turned 16. I was going to get my driver's license, actually. It was like the same time. And I found out that my best friend growing up's sister got a new job at Nintendo. And I was like, what? He's like, yeah, Nintendo's like right down the street. I grew up in Woodinville, Washington, which is right next to Redmond, Washington. And I was like, Nintendo, like the Nintendo is right down the street. And she got a job there. He's like, yeah. So we went and looked into it. And it turns out there was these things called game counselors, which were people that played all the games. And they were the guys that you talked to on the hotline. I knew who they were.
Right.
I didn't realize it was in my own backyard. And so you had to be 16 to get a job there. So as soon as I turned 16, I was like, are you kidding me? This is happening. I went down there and got the job.
That's awesome. Yeah. I mean, that would have been right around the time Nintendo Power was first sort of, I guess, about to go monthly. Because it launched in summer 88, and it was bi-monthly at that point. And then after about a year or so, it went just full monthly. And that was when they really started to go crazy on the counselor corner.
Yeah. Howard Phillips' desk was just right past the game counselor section there. So I used to see him and be like, oh, all starstruck. And yeah, there was a lot of memories from that time. It was a lot of stuff going on. This was deep in the, you know, the NES days, kind of leading up into the launch of the Super Famicom in Japan, which Nintendo vehemently denied was ever going to launch in the West, which
right.
was a really interesting
so
time.
Weird. I mean, as a kid, I wasn't even aware of, I'm just a few years younger than you. I wasn't really aware of the Super Famicom until Nintendo Power started showing it off. But I don't think there was ever any doubt that it was going to come to the US.
I think the market was so strong, the Famicom or the NES market in the United States and North America in general was just so strong. I think they knew it was an inevitability too, but they were like, listen, we're not going to address this just yet. Like, let's just keep it down and you know, tell everybody that we're not planning to bring it out here. And we all knew, of course, they're going to do it sometime. You know, the Sega Genesis was starting to pick up steam and stuff like that. But everybody's just like, all right, whatever. The boss is kind of looking at us, trying to keep a straight face. We're like, yeah, okay.
Yeah, that's something we've talked about a lot, you know, trying to decrypt some of the localization choices Nintendo made back in the day, especially with like Super Mario Brothers 2 and why we didn't get the Japanese one. And it just seems to be like the weird disconnect between launch windows in each respective territory and, you know, the fact that the NES market was really picking up right around the time the Famicom market in Japan was starting to trail off. So yeah, like they had to take different tactics to each market to maximize thing. And it's never good to
you know, tell people, oh yeah, you could, you should buy this system, but also there's a better one that's going to be on the way pretty soon. That's been, I think, every publisher or every first party's marketing line for a long time, but especially demonstrably Nintendo, you know, with like Play It Loud. And then, you know, right when the N64 came out, suddenly the message is change the system. So I guess that was, you know, kind of baked into the marketing plan way back in the day. It's interesting that you just basically applied for a job at Nintendo and got it. I mean, were there a lot of applicants? Was there like a screening process?
There was a, so at the time you wouldn't get hired on directly at Nintendo. You would be hired on as a temporary employee through, it was called Volt back then. I think it might be still around, but it was basically a temporary staffing service that would, you know, supply employees to people in need.
Yeah. I know people who have gotten jobs at Nintendo in recent years who started out as temps, and it was just basically kind of like a migration process.
Yeah. So that, you know, I went in and there was a very simple test. It was a couple questions about, you know, Legend of Zelda, like the meat puzzle with the fairy. And, there was some Super Mario Brother questions and just some really basic kind of like, do you actually have any clue what's going on about video games? I did. And, that was that. You know, there was about, in the end, there was about five or six of us from my high school that were all working there at the same time. I mean, a lot of the kids there were all local kids. They were from either Bothell or for Englemore, or Woodinville, you know, kind of Redmond, that area. It was just all people after work. I mean, a lot of the part-time employees were still college or high school students. Mm-hmm. And then a lot of the full-timers were people that had sort of, you know, either come up through that system or were kind of more adult-y types.
Right.
You know, there was a fair amount of adults that were just doing it too. I mean, it was a great job. It, you know, it paid decent. The hours were okay. And, you know, it was super fun. We had all the games we could play. You know, they super inspired us to, you know, and they kind of encouraged us to check out games from the massive library and just play stuff for free. And
that must have been rough.
Yeah, it was terrible. Just having this massive catalog, you know, and me as a 16-year-old, all of a sudden having all the free games I can play, it was pretty great. You know, and we would play games while we were working and stuff. And so, you know, I learned to really kind of multitask in talking to people, playing games, looking stuff up, you know, the computer stuff. Like I was at the end of generation where we were kind of just ending up with the big blue books full of the colored copy maps.
Right. Yeah.
Like
I heard about the binders
and stuff like that. So we still had those on standby and we did utilize them, but you know, more and more stuff was going into the Elmo system, which was a database basically where you could type in keywords. And then there were people around the office that were the experts at, you know, certain games. This guy, Dennis was the head of, like, you know, Magic of Scheherazade and Ultima, stuff like that. You know, so there's like these experts you would go and kind of get in line and wait for them to give you the quick, you know, lowdown on that. So it was really a whole game of like asking them enough questions to get enough relevant data so you could go run over to somebody else, even if you never played the game, and try to get as much kind of simple stuff. And then you'd come back and you would, you know, they trained us really well to sort of dole out the data like purposefully. Like, instead of just giving away the answer, trying to kind of like lead them into figuring out themselves, giving them little, you know, snippets and stuff like that. And so after you'd been doing it long enough, even on games you never played before, you knew how to ask leading questions and how to sort of drop in the hints to get people to kind of figure it out themselves. And they'd be like, oh, I got it. And they'd hang up. Thank you so much. And they'd hang up. You're like, okay, cool. So it was a great time. It was a great rewarding job. And, you know, it was my first time really like obviously being on the inside of the game industry and seeing a lot of this stuff. And, you know, I really sort of, I always loved video games. I always loved video games, but that really cemented my love of like, just like, you know, why would I want to work in any other field besides games? This is amazing.
How many game counselors were there at the time that you were hired at Nintendo?
There was a few. I mean,
are we talking like dozens?
More than that. It was a pretty big call center. And then you would have like, I don't think high schoolers were allowed to work more than 20 hours a week. So I worked like Monday, Wednesday, Friday, 3 to 8. And then Sunday morning, like 8 to 1 or something like that. So it was like a 20-hour shift or 20 hours a week. But there was, you know, probably at least, I mean, even on Sunday mornings when it was the quietest, and it was terrible once I got later in high school and I was, you know, starting to party, having that 8 o'clock in the morning shift was no fun. But even on the quietest mornings, there was probably at least 40 or 50 people in there. But then like on weeknights and stuff like that, it would be, you know, probably over 100 people.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize it was so big.
Yeah.
So that was a 900 number, right? Like you, or did it start out as 800?
Boy, when did it switch? It started off as a 900 number and people got really upset. And then I think they changed it to free for local callers. And then it was just like a regular long distance call for everybody else. At that point, I don't remember exactly when those things changed, but I was local, so it worked out for us. Mm. But yeah, I remember getting a lot of concerned parents being like, okay, Tommy, you got 5 minutes to talk to this man. You know, like you better figure it out. Like right. We're hanging it up then. Like, you know, I was like, don't worry, ma'am. I got this, you know, I'll speed it up a bit for you. So
that's awesome. I only ever called the counselor hotline or whatever once. And that was with Chrono Trigger. I was trying to figure out like this clue. Like I thought I was supposed to do something at the end of the game, like trying to wrap up all the side quests. And it turns out that it was just a weird choice of localization and there was nothing else to do. So I like spent $4 to basically be told, yeah, you're done. You've done everything. So, so then I had to wait, you know, I was trying to save the Princess Shala, but you can't do that in that game. I had to wait for Chrono Cross to come out. And then that's like the whole plot there. So 4 years later, I finally got my $4 worth.
I remember calling once when I think I just finished Legend of Zelda, the first Legend of Zelda. And I was so excited. I just called to tell him and he's like, oh, congratulations, man. You know, like you're number seven. You're the seventh person to finish the game. Like he's totally pulling my leg. But I was like, oh my God, went to school, told everybody, like I was so excited, you know, like it was a big deal. So it was a great crew. Like I'm still friends with a bunch of those guys. And, you know, everybody's kind of, a lot of people have stayed in the industry and obviously moved up into different, you know, facets of the industry. And then they closed the Game Counselor Center down. That building is actually gone now. They, you know, it was sort of bulldozed to make way for their fancy new headquarters now, which is really nice. But I still like to go back there and just kind of reminisce. And every once in a while, bump into somebody I recognize. It was a cool time.
Yeah, I hear people stay at Nintendo a long time.
Yeah, I think it's a good company to work for. It's one of the few companies where like people stay there for decades. You know, and, like a lot of people have just been there forever. It's just a comfortable place to work. You know, it's got a good atmosphere. There's a happiness to it. I think the new headquarters is much more sort of jovial and decorated than it was back in the day. It was pretty low key, sort of just office park stuff back then. But now it's a really beautiful campus.
Yeah, yeah. I've been there like once to the new place, and then they stopped doing PR junkets at their offices, and we just they opened a PR office in San Francisco where all the media is, which makes more sense. Like instead of flying up, you know, journalists every few months to see a game, they would just have them drive down to their offices. But I do kind of miss the, you know, the days of going up to Nintendo and getting to see Seattle. And I think the last junket I went on was for the baseball game for GameCube they never released.
Oh, wow.
And so I say junket, but I mean, it wasn't like, you know, they weren't putting money in my pocket or anything, but they gave us a tour of the Seattle ballpark, the Mariners ballpark, and took us like back into the dugouts and, you know, behind the scenes where the teams go and down onto the field. And that was pretty cool. I dug that. It was interesting. We got to go sit up in the box seats and play demos of the game and talk to the crazy new president, Reggie. So that was, yeah, good times. But yeah, it's interesting to hear about this from the inside perspective. How closely did you guys work in the call center with Nintendo Power, like their counselor corner section? I always wondered about the process.
There was, I mean, the guys that worked on that, I think, you know, a couple of them came from the call center. I forget his last name, redhead guy named Tony. There was a couple other guys that were kind of like call center part-time, but they were also contributing to the magazine. I don't think it wasn't like a regular thing. Like I was in it twice once as a game counselor.
And did you get your little photo in there?
Yeah. Oh. Back when I had a mullet.
Oh, I gotta go check that out.
I think it was the one with the TMNT on the cover.
Nice.
TMNT 3.
I'm sure I've poured over that issue.
They misspelled my name, which broke my heart because I waited for years for that. It was unbelievable. And they kind of quit doing like the bio. Like I waited for years to get in and like they used to have a little bio, like your favorite games and all these little, you know, snippets and stuff like that. And basically they just switched it to, I think it was just like a tip. And I don't think I even wrote the tip. I think someone else just read it in for me. And I was just like, oh. And then they misspelled my name. I was like, but I was in. So that was cool. And then years later, when I worked at my first like real long-term production, you know, on Twisted Edge snowboarding for N64, I got in again and they had a picture of me and all my toys and all that kind of stuff. So that was cool coming back home.
What issue was that one?
That one was Donkey Kong Diddy Kong Racing was on the cover. Twisted Edge Snowboarding was an N64 game that we did at the time, and I was like the only kind of hardcore snowboard on the team. I came up with the name Twisted Edge, me and my buddy Darren, who also worked there as a part-time tester for a while. But yeah, they did a big kind of interview on Boss Game Studios and all this kind of stuff, and had a big spread on my wall of toys, which ended up getting me the job at Sega years later because I had all these cool Sega toys and stuff like that. So I'm sure we'll get to that.
Interesting. Yeah. So how long were you a game counselor?
About 2.5 years, I think, from the fall of 89 till the fall, maybe it was 2 years, fall of 91, I think. Hmm.
So you dropped out because you just couldn't handle a newfangled 16-bit hardware.
Yeah, I think I actually quit before the Super Nintendo launched, but I was around for the Super Famicom launch. And in fact, I got a Christmas bonus that year, and I bought a Super Famicom. I imported one from, I think, Game Fan, or probably, was it Lixon?
Was one of those early still around back then? NCS, I think, was around.
Maybe it was Intronics. Yeah. But I don't remember. It was one of those guys, and I spent my entire bonus on from Nintendo to Nintendo. Got a Super Famicom with Gradius and Super Mario World and
That's awesome.
Pilot Wings, F-Zero. I think ActRaiser may have been right after that.
That was December, and the system launched in November. So if you did it right at launch, you would have missed out on ActRaiser.
I remember getting in high school, I had finals and stuff, and I went snowboarding one night because it was close to the mountains up there, and I got back at like midnight. I knew I had to wake up at like 6 for a full day of taking finals at high school. And my mom's like, she was still awake. She's like, this big package came for you. I'm like, no, not tonight. No, God. Of course I'm not going to sleep.
So Sophie's
I stayed
choice
up,
right
stayed there. Up and played Super Mario World on my, you know, all in Japanese. I didn't read a lick of Japanese back then. So I just kind of, that actually, I think, added to the experience because it was like even more mysterious.
Right.
And more
yeah.
I don't know what the hell is going on in any capacity here. I'm just going to figure it out by kind of hammering through it. And I remember that first time that bullet bill came by and just took up the whole screen and blew my mind.
You know, when you look back at it, it's only like a quarter of the screen high, but it seemed like the full screen at the time. You were just like, what the hell?
I mean, that was, you know, 10 times bigger than any sprite that I'd ever seen before.
Yeah.
So it just
that's a cool experience. Nintendo's call center, where did you go from there?
So I took some, I took some time off. I convinced my parents that I needed to study and focus on my studies. I was just tired of doing the Sunday morning 5 o'clock thing, I think. I mean, the money was great. I had a good time. But during that time, there was another guy, Llewellyn, who was a super agent, which means he was doubly trained on all the game counselor stuff and all the IT sort of customer support stuff. And he had this... it was right when Dragon Quest was coming out, Warrior.
So 89.
Yeah. He had a, like this Dragon Warrior, maybe something else.
Yeah. Didn't he have a section in Nintendo Power? I feel like the name Llewellyn is ringing a chord.
Yeah. He was a big deal those days. I forget what year it was exactly, but Dragon Warrior was published by Nintendo First Party. Mm-hmm. The first one was published in-house by Nintendo First Party. They translated everything. It was a big deal. I remember like the excitement leading up to it. They were like, we're going to introduce this role-playing genre to the West. It's going to be a big deal. We're going to do this thing. And he had this poster somehow that I had never seen before. And like nobody else had it. And I was like, where did you get that? And he's like, didn't you know NX's headquarters is right down the street? And I was like, no. So that kind of planted a seed. And then I... in high school, I was playing these other games, and I sort of must have been right when the Super Famicom kind of towards that launch period when I must have quit Nintendo around that time, and I was playing a bunch of ActRaiser, and I got stuck in ActRaiser, and there was no internet back then, and there was no one to call, so I looked up the Annex's addresses, and I went down to they're in this little business park, and I went down, and they had a game counselor. And he's like, well, I'm not supposed to really, talk about that game yet because it's not released here yet. But I have played through it and I do know what you're talking about. So I'll just kind of give you this tin. He walked me through it. I forget what it was, one of the puzzles that I just, like, if you didn't read Japanese, it wasn't that.
Yeah, you have to, like, use music and stuff to cure anger.
Yeah, something. It was one of those kind of more sickness, obscure things. And I was like, I never would have been able to do it without him. Rob Gerald, he's still in the games industry too. He's a producer at Microsoft. So I just kind of, I was like, oh man, this is even closer to this horse. Like, you know, they had this Japanese boss and like, it was this cool little office. They had all this cool art. And I was so into ActRaiser. I started bugging him for a job and like, it was years. Like I would keep just checking in every couple months. I was like, Hey, and they only had the one game counselor and they're like, nope, we still don't need any other employees. And then finally he got sort of promoted to, kind of more of a producer role with, they were doing external development, but it was in the Seattle area on the King Arthur game.
Okay.
And so he got sort of transferred out of their little tiny call center, which was a single little tiny, you know, office. And so he called me up and I think I had just graduated from high school at the time. And he offered me the job. Finally, he's like, you know, you've been coming in for years. I'm going to give it to you first. I was like, sweet. So I took it. And so I worked at NX for, it was only about a year or so, I think, that I was there. But I mean, I got to meet Miyazaki-san of the Quintet crew and stuff
oh,
like
man,
that.
That's
and
awesome.
I was just like, whoa, man.
They came,
so
they
cool.
came to the US occasionally?
Yeah. Well, they were doing, I guess they were working up towards ActRaiser 2. Mm-hmm. And so we got to meet them and talk to them.
All right. That was collaborative with like a US.
Yeah.
Designer.
So the US office actually made the decision to sort of remove the role playing stuff yes. from it, which I thought was just a boner move.
Yes.
I was like, no, man, you're killing me. So the second game, I never got nearly as into as the first one. I mean, it was beautiful.
Yeah. It's one of the best looking platformers on any Super NES. And it's also one of the hardest. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. I played it years later, even with like a cheat code enabled. And like, you still just die all the time. Like, it's almost impossible to just like be good at that game. Like, it was a tricky game. I don't know if they, you know, rushed it or whatever, but it didn't feel the same as the first one. I mean, definitely, like you said, fidelity, the graphic fidelity was phenomenal, but as a game, it just didn't quite bring it. But anyways, ActRaiser brought me to NX, and that led me to sort of realizing Rob was producing this King Arthur game with Manly and Associates, who were based in Issaquah at the time. They were a small sort of studio.
Yeah, I've seen their name on a few like NES and maybe Game Boy games.
Yeah, so he knew that I liked to draw. I would spend a lot of time in their drawing and kind of this was like when I think Edge was just coming out then. I was like reading Edge and just spending a lot. Like, it was way quieter at NX. So there was one game counselor for a reason. Like, it was way quieter
right.
than the other thing. Most questions were about the Dragon Warrior games
right.
at the time.
I assume you had to have super deep knowledge of the Dragon Warrior games because people would ask you questions and they'd
be. Did, but again, Rob had been doing it for years
right.
and he sat, you know, 5 feet from me. So like, I mean, I would play through them all. I played through all the games. But he just like, he had him down. It was way faster for me to be like, hey, dude, you know, what's this thing? This guy's looking for this castle. And I remember that part. Mm. So he kind of walked me through all that stuff. But then he started showing me the art from the Mailing Associates stuff. And I was like, wow, like people actually make these games. Like there are humans out there that do this stuff. And that's not just like a deep in Japan thing. I mean, I didn't realize that there was like literally local developers doing, you know, cool game stuff like that. And so that sort of inspired me to, I mean, I hated walking away from that job because I loved NX and I loved everything about the brand. But I ended up going to art school and realizing that I wanted to be a, you know, production artist. I didn't want to just sort of be on the outside looking in. So I went off and got went to art college and then ended up getting a job at Lobotomy Studios right after I graduated, like literally Monday after I graduated on a Friday. And Lobotomy was run by a bunch of ex-game counselors that had been sort of some of my leads when I was at Nintendo back in the day. They had rolled off and started their own production studio. And so they gave me my first job right out of college. I was only there for about a month. I was an intern. We were kind of between projects, didn't have any funding. And then Rob from NX was working at Boss, and he said, hey, come over here. We're expanding. You know, they've got great salaries, and it's a big kind of corporate thing. It's exactly what you need to be doing right now with your life. So he helped me, you know, get introduced to the art director and brought me in for an interview and stuff like that. So I got that job. And that was where, you know, I really dove into production and was an animator and modeler and stuff like that, and learned a lot of the basic tricks of the trade. And really became a game creator at that point.
I would like to talk a little more about your time at NX because, you know, I really love the games they make too. And like their Super NES output was really quirky and distinct. And there were, you know, there were a few little gaps in their library that always kind of seemed like a big loss, like Dragon Quest V, whatever. Do you know whatever happened with that?
I think it was just the translation cost. Sorry about the banging here, folks. They're tearing down the scaffolding on an old house that's being restored right next to our office.
Well, that's what happens when we're on site. It's out of our control.
The Famicom could only handle like certain resolutions. So they used a lot of the simpler characters and stuff, which took up more space than just
like in text,
kanji.
You mean?
Yeah.
Text characters.
But with the Super Famicom stuff, it was, you know, they could pack in a lot more kanji. And when you unpacked that, it turned into, you know, words that were much longer, and it just led to a lot more complex localization services, and the whole process just became a lot more sort of involved and expensive. And I think that's why some of the key big Japanese titles just didn't make it over there. I don't know who, you know, exactly what the decision was, but like there was some sort of trade-off between time and money, and they were just like, well, you know. And Dragon Warrior never took off in the West, like anywhere near the way that it did in the East. So
I know Nintendo really, you know, put a lot of hopes into it, and they pimped it really hard in Nintendo Power. And, you know, I was a good little boy, and I got a copy for Christmas that year. And I know I'm kind of in a small minority, relatively speaking, because they ended up – I've assumed that the Nintendo Power giveaway where you subscribed and you got a copy of Dragon Warrior, that was like – leftover copies of the game that they didn't sell. Do you know if that's true, or if it's more a matter of just
like the moment you said that, it rang a bell, but I don't recall the details.
Okay.
I mean, I remember being, you know, hearing conversations like that, but I don't, it's been so long. I don't remember.
But yeah, whatever the case, I mean, they were like literally giving away Dragon Warrior so people would get into the series, but it just never, it's never been as big in the US as in Japan. I hope 11 does well in America, because it's a really good game.
Yeah, they're all great
games.
It
looks great.
You know, I think the decision to redo all the art for the packaging was a mistake. Like, they had such strong branding in the East. You know, Akira Toriyama's artwork was always just so stunning. Those covers are always amazing. They're still some of my favorite cover art. And they just kind of got random people to do these kind of like really sort of generic sort of, you know, fantasy sort of covers for the games. And I feel like, I mean, this was not just NX by any means. I mean, all companies at the time were like, well, this stuff is too Japanese and too wacky. Let's get some, you know, fantasy artists here in the West to redo this whole thing and rebrand everything. And I just think it was just pure foolishness. I think, you know, there was so much work and so much love and TLC put into the original packaging that just dumping all that for the sake of trying to do something that hit closer to home, I think it was just stupid.
Yeah, so. I mean, the in-game characters that Toriyama designs are so full of personality. Like, you know, everything from the little basic smiling slime to the big dragons that are kind of like, looking at you from, you know, with their heads tilted askew, and they have this kind of sly expression, like, I'm about to eat a really delicious meal. Like, it's great. There's so much personality in that series. And yeah, I agree. Like, the US packaging, it was pretty nice. Like, the first box was not so great, but the sequels had some really nice paintings, but they didn't
They're
really
nice paintings, but yeah, they don't
capture the essence,
the spirit of the actual product. And I just, that always just drove me nuts. I'm like, why?
Yeah. I mean, you know, you have some really infamous examples of just like, what are you doing? Like the Suikoden US packaging, where it's like a bad romance cover, or Clash of Demon Head for NES, where you have like a game that is maybe the most anime game on NES, and it has just like ripping biceps and shiny chrome and helpless damsels and scanty skirts. I'm like, guys, no.
I mean, it was a different time. And I think now, if anybody could go back, they would have changed their minds and, you know, stuck closer to the source material. But, you know, that was just kind of the standard issue for whatever reason back in the day. And so, but yeah, so we did a lot of weirder stuff there too. You know, I forget some of the names. I mean, I remember playing them all, but a lot of quirky stuff. A lot of it wasn't even NX stuff, I don't think.
Yeah, a lot of it was Quintet. Quintet had like 6 games that came to Super Famicom. So that was like almost, like, I think, like half of NX's US output. There was also EVO, Seventh Saga.
Was it Paladin's Quest? That was one of them.
I think, was that by NX?
They published it in the States. Well, NX never, this took me a long time to realize this. They didn't actually do much in-house stuff. Everything was, you know, given to somebody. But the Quintet was like as good as an internal studio. And it bummed me out that they never played, they never brought in any of the other stuff like Terranigma. And even Europeans got it. And this release of that, like, why it didn't come to the West.
Yeah.
Into the far West, I suppose. It doesn't make any sense to me. But that was a bummer, because that's one of my favorite series of all time. In fact, my first game credits ever is in Seoul.
Illusion of Gaia.
That's the one.
Yeah, that was what prompted this this podcast in the first place, because I saw that photo of like the ending, and I was like, oh my god, I didn't realize that you had worked on the game. Like, did you do any localization for it, or was it just like a game counselor?
I was just
like,
sort of playtesting it. I mean, we were going to release it, you know, internally through NX, and then I guess this was obviously post the Dragon Warrior 1 kind of collab with NOA. And so there was a point where they're like, actually, we're going to let them do this, and it's going to be a much bigger thing. It's good for us. You know, they can put a lot more effort in marketing and stuff.
Yeah, yeah, they did.
And really sell the brand. And so it was just weird. I remember that.
Yeah, it came in that big box with a t-shirt in it and everything.
Yeah. So I was just sort of playtesting, looking for bugs and, you know, kind of giving it a final pass. And then I was a game counselor on it, but I got my name in the credits. And that was a big moment for me, obviously. I was, you know, just such a huge fan of that stuff. I mean, Soul Blazer still, like, it's so dated. But when I first played it, that game just took me away. Like, I just...
I still love Soul Blazer. I'm a huge fan of that game. And ActRaiser, too. I recently, you know, did this huge video retrospective on it. And going back and playing through it in its entirety, I was just like...
It's so good. I still, that's probably one of the only games I go back every couple of years and just play it again, just because it's so good. I mean, the action is pretty standard issue. It's not like amazing, but it was solid and it looked great.
It's more than the sum of its parts.
Yeah,
it's the magic of that.
The essence, like the whole package is just like such a great thing. The music, I mean, Yuzo Koshiro's soundtrack to that still just is one of the best soundtracks of all time, I think. And just, you know, the world and the font. I mean, everything about it. I love it so much. Like, it really has formed kind of a big chunk of who I am, you know, the kind of games I like and the kind of stuff I like to play. I mean, that game is definitely one of the top three sort of influences, I think, just on my general psyche as a creator.
That's awesome. They just kind of vanished.
They did. I think they did a Saturn game.
Yeah, they did. And they did, I think, a Dreamcast
PlayStation game.
They did a like a launch PlayStation Dreamcast game called Godzilla Generations.
Godzilla Generations.
Yeah, that was. I'm pretty sure that was.
I remember that. Yeah, and I was all excited about it because it was Quintet, but like I just wasn't that into Godzilla. I liked their original IP. Yeah, I think they just sort of faded away. They had some PlayStation game that I never played. I don't think it ever launched in English.
The racing game, like the racing RPG, or was maybe, that Saturn? I don't know.
That sounds more like the Saturn one, maybe. Wait, it's been a while.
Yeah,
but yeah, they never got back.
Oh, Grandstream Saga. That was it.
That's right.
But that wasn't really Quintet. That was Shade, which apparently was like made of
Quintet members or something.
People, yeah.
Funny story.
Quintet was ex Falcom, so it's just like, you know, leave one burning bridge behind or whatever. Go to the next.
Funny actress, your story just randomly. So I worked at Lobotomy for that internship. Right after I graduated from art school and became friends with a bunch of those guys who are still like, you know, some of my dearest friends in the world right now. In fact, Paul Schreiber was with 17-Bit for years. He just recently sort of retired and he's off on his own little hermit quest. But Kevin Chung was a good buddy of mine from those years. And he had this pen pal in Japan. His dad had met this guy's dad at some conference or something like that. And so they were going back and forth with like letters, like old school pen pals. And they had been for years. And so when I was at Lobotomy, I think he sent over like Japanese version of Virtua Fighter 2 and the action sticks. I think it was like the arcade sticks for Tekken or something like that. And I was like, what? Where'd you get this stuff? He's like, oh, my friend. Like, I've never actually met him, but he's in Japan and we've been pen pals for years. And he sends me cool stuff. I send him cool stuff. Long story short, I ended up, you know, getting the job at Sega. And then this... Kevin is like, I'm going to come to Japan. I want to come hang out. I'm going to spend a week with you. I'm going to spend a week with this guy, Yamachan. He called him Hinato at the time, which is his first name, but everybody calls him Yamachan. And so he came out and we were hanging out and he totally fell in love with Tokyo. He was just like, you know, totally fanboyed out, just like everybody is when they first come there. And he ended up, introducing me to Yamachan, who became my best friend for life. We've been best friends for coming on 20 years now. And who lived right up the street. But he also met, I don't know how this happened, but he met Yuzo Koshiro. And he ended up getting a job at Ancient.
Wow.
So I was like, oh my God, like I'm a huge fan of Koshiro-san. Like, how can I, you know, I would love to meet him someday. He's like, yeah, no problem. Let's just go to dinner or something like that. So we went to this, he invited me to dinner one time. And we went out and I was, a bunch of people I didn't know. And, you know, I was talking to Koshiro-san. And there's this lady sitting in front of me. And, you know, we're just kind of chatting. And like, my Japanese was pretty spotty at the time. And I think she spoke some English. I don't remember the conversation. It was a long time ago. But long story short, we were chatting, and I was just like, you know, kind of, so like, what do you do? She's like, oh, I'm an artist. I'm like, this is my husband. He works at a newspaper or something like that. I was like, that's cool. She's like, what kind of stuff do you do? She's like, well, you know,
uses my brother, and so I work with him on stuff. I was like, oh, really? She's like, yeah, I did all the art for this game called ActRaiser. I was like, what? She's like, yeah, yeah.
I didn't realize that was her.
Yeah, okay. Ayako Shiro. Maybe she's got a different name. I think she was married, but it was Yuzo's sister. Mm-hmm. And she had done the environments, and I think she did a lot of the characters and stuff like that. And so the rest of the dinner was shot. I was just like, tell me more. And like diving in, you know, like, oh my God. Like I was so, it was probably pretty awkward for her. Like I couldn't help myself, but completely just fanboy. Like, what are the odds you're going to sit down at a dinner with the artist to basically one of your favorite games of all time? And so that blew my mind. So Kevin was at Ancient for a couple of years doing a bunch of different stuff. And so I still have a dream of doing kind of a classic inspired 16-bit era experience updated for the modern world. And I would love to work with Koshiro-san. So I've actually told him, I was like, someday we're going to work together and I would love to get you to do the soundtrack. So.
I mean, the ActRaiser genre is sadly underrepresented.
I know, right? I was like, can we get the rights to ActRaiser 3?
Action simulation RPGs in the market.
And I don't know if it would have any spot in today's market, but I feel like with the cool indie stuff and the boom of stuff going on.
I think that style of game would do a lot better now than it did at the time. I mean, I think ActRaiser did okay for itself, but I feel people are a lot more open to genre bending concepts and games that step outside the lanes. And I mean, genre means almost nothing these days. It was much more rigid back in the 80s and 90s, but now it's like, you know, you have stuff like, I don't know, like Stardew Valley or something, which is, it's a lot of things all at once. Or Undertale. Is it a shooter? Is it an RPG? Is it a visual novel? What is it? It's a lot of things. Yeah, so I agree. Indie space is like very, very ripe for that. So
that's my dream. We're running something that's different now. But yeah, it is going to happen at some point. Like I definitely want to make that game. So that's something I've been thinking about a lot lately. Maybe for the next title after this one we're just starting up now.
So I'm not really familiar with Lobotomy. I've heard of them, but I don't know what kind of games they tended to work on. What did you do there?
I was an artist. Mm-hmm. They're best known for, they did an original shooter. I think, am I wrong? It was based on the id engine. It could be, it could not be. I forget. It may be based on the Doom engine. It was called Power Slave.
Oh, okay. That's why I know them. Yeah.
Yeah. And so that was a really cool title. It was really well done. I mean, it was a bunch of young guys that hadn't done like game stuff before, but they'd worked in games, you know, kind of on the other side of stuff. That ended up doing really well, but they also are really well known for their lead engineer was phenomenal. Ezra, he was just an animal, and they did the Quake port to Saturn.
Okay.
Which just didn't make any sense.
Yeah. I've heard that's an amazing port. Like technically, like it shouldn't be able to do what it does.
It just doesn't make sense. Yeah, it just looks so good. And then they did, I think, as a part of Power Slave, like a little omake thing was Death Tank, which was kind of really popular. Okay. It was like a 16-person, old school arcade inspired. Like you were little tanks shooting at each other, kind of Missile Command meets Moon Rover sort of thing. We used to spend a lot of time banging on that. So it was Paul Lang and Brian McNeely, who's at Nintendo now still. Kevin Chung is back at Nintendo too. Those guys are all in the NST software development section. Paul, I think, he was at Microsoft for a long time in charge of the Flight Sim stuff. I don't know what he's doing now. I think he switched roles recently. But they were like just hardcore dudes. It was like the quintessential indie game studio. But this is before indie games were a thing. It was just a small game studio in this cheap, beat up old leaky warehouse with rats and stuff. And it was just a bunch of dudes in their 20s, just like not sleeping enough, you know, eating pizza and drinking soda. Like that literally the quintessential like nerdy game dev heaven. We had these two really cool artists, John and Troy. They both like cut big rockers, long hair, and like drawn muscular dudes and all this stuff. And it was just I was like, this is awesome. Game development is so cool. Like, why would you ever go get a real job? This is so much fun. But you know, they were struggling. Like that was my first peek behind the scenes of like, wow, you have to sign deals and you have to pay everybody. And running a game studio is hard. And like, I didn't have to worry about that stuff. I was young and I was just doing my art stuff. But, you know, even then, like the desperation of them trying to get the next gig signed so I could get a full contract and stuff, like it was too much pressure. So when I did leave, went over to Boss Games, they had giant corporate backing, these big deals with BMG. And, you know, they were like fully, fully funded. Boss Games was based on Boss Film, which was Richard Edlund, who was a VFX master from Star Wars and Larry Raiders, Lost Ark and all this kind of stuff. And so they had spun up this game division. So that was my first like big corporate job, but like it was definitely, that was fun too. Learned a lot of great lessons, made a lot of great friends, but the the spirit of the lobotomy guy is just this house run by passion. Like everyone just complete game fanatics. Like it was just such a great, you know, diving into that world after some of this kind of more corporate stuff after Nintendo and NX. This was like just purely passion driven.
Right.
Not a lot of logic, but it was, you know, that, there was a real energy there that I, you know, that's why I like having a small studio now. I like that level of just like, wow, we're all here because we want to be, we believe in what we're doing. And it's a very different thing than just kind of having a 9-to-5 job.
Minus the not sleeping enough and the rats, right?
We're over that now. We're old enough now. You know, more than half of us are our parents. And so we keep pretty good hours here. That's another story.
That's the way to do it. But yeah, it's interesting. You're talking about kind of the realization of the business realities behind game development and publishing. It kind of seems like you made the jump from the publishing side to the development side right around, you know, a really huge transition in the medium. Maybe the biggest transition. I guess the leap to HD consoles was also right up there. But, you know, you went from Genesis and Super NES and 2D games to 3D games on Saturn and PlayStation. And a lot of companies didn't make the jump. They didn't survive the shakeout. So it feels like just the nature of what the business was changed a lot then. So you kind of got a face full of it right at the start.
It was an exciting time. The first big project that I did at Boss was Spider, which was a 2.5D.
Oh, yeah.
2.5D platformer. And at the time, we thought we were the first. We were like, wow, this is going to be great. It's like a 2D platformer, but it's a 3D world, and you can kind of move around. The camera moves around, tracks and stuff like that. That's where I first did like scripting and level design and stuff like that. And we were so excited. We're like, we're going to be the first. This is going to be amazing.
Did Crystal Dynamics beat you?
Pandemonium came out, and we were like, I mean, I guess it was a no-brainer. Someone was going to do it, and they nailed it, and it was a great game. And then Klonoa came out not long after that, which was also fucking fabulous. Love that game. But yeah, that was cool. And then, funnily enough, tying the past and the future together, we started playing Cool Borders when it came out. I forget if it was Saturn or PlayStation. It might have been the PlayStation version. And we were kind of looking for the next thing to do after Spider. And so Rob from NX and I were like super excited about Cool Borders. We played a bunch of it. And we were like trying to pitch a snowboarding game. And so they finally bit off on it and we decided to do it. And so also, ironically, a bunch of the guys from the King Arthur team and Manly & Associates were at Bossgame Studios. And I was like, oh my God, like, you know, this has all come full circle. This is so crazy. So, because that kind of, you know, kicked off this whole thing. And so we worked together post Spider on Twisted Edge Snowboarding, thinking we were going to be the first big snowboarding game. And we were so excited and we were doing all this stuff. And it was, you know, a great team. And we were having a lot of fun. And we're like, wow, we're going to be the first N64 snowboarding game. This is going to be amazing. And Nintendo's like, cool. Yeah, yeah. No, that's great. Yeah, well, you guys, you know, right up in there. Let's do it. Boom. Out of nowhere, 1080 comes out. You know, it's an amazing game by Nintendo. I'm like, oh, they didn't mention that. And I forget if they beat us to market.
Nintendo likes to play things close to their vest.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. But the reason that's so funny is because we had this intense rivalry now or then. And then, you know, years with, later, with I moved to Kyoto and I'm good buddies with Giles Goddard, who was the lead programmer on that. And we have this friendly rivalry where I like to make fun of him. When we go up snowboarding, we go, you know, he drives me up in his Range Rover and we take pictures and stuff. And it's always Twisted Edge team versus the 1080 nice. Team. So it's just years later in hindsight, it's just so funny that, you know, that affected me so much at the time. And, you know, I met him years and years later, but yeah, he runs another studio here at Vitae in Kyoto that was worked with Nintendo for years. So he's a legend in his own right. You know, him and Dylan Cuthbert were both on Star Fox. And Dylan went on after that and went back to the Sony America and stuff like that. But Giles stayed at Nintendo for years. He did the Mario face, the squishy face for N64 Mario. You know, he helped with the physics on Wave Race and stuff like that. So Wave Race is actually also one of my favorite games of all time. I liked 1080, but not as much as I like Wave Race. So
yeah, there is something about Wave Race. It's weird. I don't even really like sports games or extreme sports games, but the feel of that game, like even
magic.
Even the follow up, like Blue Storm, did not. Nope. It didn't catch. Didn't I don't catch know what it was.
I was so excited about that too, but it wasn't the same.
It's weird. Like it's so low resolution now and so kind of abstract, but the water feels so convincing. It's really crazy.
It felt so real. I mean, that was the most, I think, addicted maybe that I've ever been to a game. I had a big TV right next to my bed while I was working. I think it was when I was working at Boss. And until I fell asleep at night. And the first thing in the morning, I would just reach over, click it on, and jump in to play some races. My girlfriend almost left me. She's like, you have a problem. Like, this is just too much. I'm like, this game is so good. It's so much fun. Like, I just can't stop playing it. And it's never the same. That's the thing with the waves and the physics. It's like you have strategies and kind of how to deal with this stuff. But every time you jump in there, it's this fresh experience and you have to just sort of make way, you know, do the best you can with what you get. And, yeah, that game, man, it hit close to the pulse. Like, there's almost nothing like it. I still love that game so much.
Digster has a playlist for every moment, mood, and minute of your life. Digster is soundtracking your world one playlist at a time. Check out digster.fm to see for yourself. There are thousands of great playlists for you to enjoy. That includes, yes, the crusty 70s British prog rock I love, as well as Bob's more upbeat favorites. We both teamed up with Digster to create our own playlists, each with a mix of our own respective favorites. Go to digster.fm/Bob and digster.fm/Jeremy to see our playlists, which you can follow, share, and listen to. They're updated regularly. This week, my playlist has a few new entries that include Canadian power trio Rush's The Trees, one of rock's most misunderstood tunes. As kids, we all thought it was about Canadians throwing shade at the U.S., but now that we're older, it's clearly just an objectivist morality play. And of course, you can brighten your day with Bob's custom playlist of jangly indie rock, or just check out Digster's thousands of other playlists like Classic Rockers Then and Now, which showcases the best current tunes of rock legends side by side with the hits that made them big. Be sure to follow our playlists so you can listen over and over. Again, go to digster.fm/Bob and digster.fm/Jeremy and listen to our playlists. And be sure to check out digster.fm in general for the best mix of music for every moment, mood, and minute of your life.
I want to take a minute and talk about underwear. Yes, underwear. Everybody needs it, and new is better than old. And they have to be comfortable, so you should get some MeUndies. Folks, I know what you're saying, Bob. You keep bothering us about underwear every week. You know what? I've made it my mission in life that every listener out there will be comfortable in their groinal regions with a nice pair of MeUndies underpants. And if you like high-pressure sales tactics, I have an offer for you, a no-risk offer. If you're not happy, MeUndies will refund the cost, and you get to keep them. And because you're listening to Retronauts, you'll get 15% off your first pair and free shipping. If that sounds good to you, go to MeUndies.com/retro. That's MeUndies.com/retro. And here's an extra gift for you. Order a pair, take a screenshot of your transaction, and send it to me, and I'll send you another pair. And by I mean MeUndies, because I'm not going to be sending you people underwear. I have better things to do. You get one for 15% off and another pair from me for free. And by me, I mean MeUndies. I can't stress that enough. The first 25 people to send a proof of purchase, a screenshot of your purchase, or of the receipt, I'll send you another pair free. Again, I mean MeUndies. The company MeUndies will send you the underwear. I will not be touching them in any way. Just send your proof to gift@podcastone.com and put retro in the subject line, and you will soon have another pair in your collection. Let's do this. MeUndies.com/retro.
No matter who you are, brushing your teeth is one of the most important parts of your day to stay healthy. Quip knows that, and their team of dentists and designers is focused on helping you take care of your mouth better. Quip is an electric toothbrush that costs a fraction of bulkier brushes, but still packs just the right amount of vibrations to help clean your teeth. Quip has a built-in timer to help you clean the dentist-recommended way, and they offer new brush heads on a dentist-recommended schedule every 3 months for just $5, including free shipping worldwide. With Quip, you don't have to worry about getting new brush heads or toothpaste. They're delivered right to your door on schedule, so you replace your brush on time and have better oral hygiene at an affordable price. It's not just for convenience, it's for your health, too. Quip has appeared on Oprah's O-List, was named one of Time's Best Inventions, and is the first subscription electric toothbrush accepted by the American Dental Association. Quip starts at just $25, and if you go to getquip.com/retro right now, you'll get your first refill pack free with a Quip electric toothbrush. That's your first refill pack free at getquip.com/retro. GetQuip.com/retro.
If you like my show, you're not going to want to miss Beyond the Darkness here on Podcast One. It's a weekly look at all things paranormal with world-renowned researchers and experiencers. They challenge everything we think we know about ghosts, ghouls, angels, demons, aliens, monsters, and more. So check out Beyond the Darkness weekly on Podcast One, PodcastOne.com, and Apple Podcasts. Also remember to rate and review.
So after Twisted Edge, what was the next on the docket for you? Were you still with Boss, or at what point did you jump over to Sega?
I was still at Boss. We started working on World Rally Championship, which was an N64 racing game. Funnily enough, I think I was doing the Kyoto track, now that I think about it. I did a big Buddha statue, and I was working on that, and I ended up doing this big Buddha statue, and I had room left in my level for Twisted Edge before it had shipped. And I remember I took that Buddha and I put it like in this back bowl you could find, and you could look up on the hill and there's this huge Buddha statue. And I thought it was an amazing Easter egg. And they ended up taking it out probably for texture space reasons or whatever. Years later, Midway published some other world rally or world racing game on arcade. And it was like, you're driving through the Japan track, whatever, and like that big Buddha statue. I'm like, that's my Buddha statue. I know that's my Buddha statue because Midway had published that game.
Right.
And I still don't understand how it's even possible, but I know it was mine. Like, I mean, you UV mapped the whole thing, and like, I knew that was my thing. So I'm still curious, how's that ever happened?
Was that Cruisin' World?
Maybe. It was one of the Midway sort of like those sprite-based things. But maybe it was the Polygon one. It's been a while. Long story short, while at Sega, I was reading Edge magazine, as I always did. I'm a huge fan of Edge. I was reading up on Tetsuya Mizuguchi. He had just come out in this thing. There was a big article on him and his love of club music and Sega Rally. I loved Sega Rally. Sega Rally is also one of those games that just, like, you know, changed my sort of direction in life forever. Like, I played that game so much. It was in the arcade across the street from my animation college. So we would, you know, go over and just get drunk on Friday nights and play the hell out of that game. And then I had it on Saturn, and me and my roommate would just have these intense competitions, like, you know, down to the fraction of a second. And he'd leave it on when he beat my time, and I'd be so pissed off. anyways, so I read all about Mizuguchi, and I knew all about him, and I was a huge Sega Rally fan. And I had been to Japan. I went to Japan. This is kind of off the beaten track, but I went to Japan between Nintendo and NX. And I went just randomly. I was in college. I did a semester over in this little community college that had a branch office from Seattle over in the hills outside of Kobe. And so I spoke a little tiny bit of Japanese, and I'd been surrounded by the culture enough. And it was kind of right during the Street Fighter II, like, explosions. I had all these Street Fighter toys, and like, Virtua Fighter stuff was just starting to come online. So I had all these Japanese toys that I would pick up from my trip there. And I had them all at my desk, that Nintendo Power thing I was talking about. And just randomly, on a given day, we had a new release of Alias Power Animator, pre-Maya, like the new version of Alias Power Animator, whatever. And so one of their engineers from Alias came to the studio to tour around, talk the artists through the new features and kind of get them up to speed. And he had like a half hour with each artist to kind of like walk through some of the new features and stuff like that. He sits down at my desk. He's this American guy. And he's like, wow, you got a bunch of cool Japanese toys. Like, you've been to Japan? I was like, yeah, love Japan. I want to go work at Sega Japan someday. Like, I'd never even like really processed that. Like, I was just such a Sega fan of the stuff they were doing. I don't know. Like, literally, I just burst it out. It was like so weird. I just was like, I want to work at Sega someday in Japan. He's like, oh, I used to work there. And I'm like, what? He's like, yeah, I used to work with this guy, Tetsuya Mizuguchi. I worked on Sega Rally and stuff. And I'm like, what? Really? He's like, yeah, I'm long, medium, left. That's me. I was like, holy shit. Are you kidding me? Oh my God, like, oh my God. It was like all of a sudden, like, you know, the Alias stuff is out the window. I'm like asking all these questions, just totally pestering about, you know, what it's like to work at Sega Japan. So he was there for years working directly with Mizuguchi-san, who's an engineer. And this was like a couple weeks before E3. And so I had no business going to E3 on the company dime that year, but I was like, all right, I'm going to go down, you know, like I'm super excited about this. He's like, he's coming. If you want, I can try to hook you up. You can just meet him or whatever. I was like, he's like, yeah, he speaks English. And I was like, oh my God, like what are the odds? This is crazy. So of course I take a week of work off and I go down there and he emailed me. He's like, hey, I heard from my friend Kenneth that you'd like to meet. And he was like, that's cool. It was E3 1998 in Atlanta. He's like, let's meet outside the Sega booth, like whatever time. And I couldn't believe it. So I kind of whipped together a demo reel, got a bunch of my paintings and my animations and like all the stuff. And my friend that I worked with, Kip, great guy. He helped me kind of, he was a video editor. He kind of put this whole thing together and put music to it. Like it was this bang up demo reel. And so I brought that with me to E3 and I met Mizuguchi-san and we totally hit it off. I showed him my reel. He watched it a couple times back to back and was like, this is cool. And I was like, listen, man, like I know this is forward, but like, please give me a job. Like I want to move to Japan. I want to come join you. Sega Japan's the coolest place on the planet. Like, please, 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 please. And so he's like, all right, calm down. You know, like let's relax a little bit. He's like, why don't we go get drinks again later this week and we'll talk some more. So we went out and went for dinner and drinks and we're just chatting. And I was a huge fan of, I'd gone to animation school. So I was, you know, kind of starting to really get into that sort of mid 90s anime and really kind of diving into that stuff. And I loved Macross Plus. And Macross mm-hmm. Plus was like my favorite anime. And there's a one scene, the concert scene, where the Sharon Apple concert scene mm-hmm. is like leagues above the rest of the stuff. It's like this super psychedelic, beautiful, all kind of driven by the beats and the music. Right. It's like this club music with this psychedelic over-the-top experience. And I knew that it had been animated by, like that scene alone had been directed by my favorite animation director, this guy Koji Morimoto, who mm-hmm. was the animation director on Akira. And he's done a bunch of other crazy, weird kind of underground stuff. And I was like, obsessed with this video clip, like the way that the music all came together and it was like this psychedelic, sexy, languid like experience, like all blending into itself. And I just couldn't get over it. And so, you know, after a couple of drinks, especially, I started getting all excited and I'm chatting with him and he's like, if you could make any game, what would you want to do? And I was like, oh, and I started explaining the scene to him and I was like, yeah, I'm sure you never heard of this guy. He's this weird animator and he did this thing and it's like the music and I'm like going nuts about it. And he just starts chuckling, and I was like, well, I'm sure you've never heard of him. And he's like, actually, I own an animation studio down the street from Sega, I'm a part owner of this animation studio on the street. And Morimoto-san works for us. He's actually designing a new film right now. And I was like, what? He's like, yeah, I'm a big fan of that concert scene too. And I was like, well, that's, you know, I want to make a game about that. Like, I want to make a game like that. He's like, well, I do too. He's like, okay, maybe you should come out and see me in Japan. So I'm freaking out at this point. I had just taken a week off to go to E3. I was like 22 years old, you know, like I'd basically eaten up my entire vacation time. I go back to work and I walked in my boss's office. He's like, I'm so sorry. There's an emergency. I need to take another week off. He's like, what? I'm like, yeah, total emergency. Sorry. Got to go. So I couldn't control myself. So I went to Tokyo, hung out with Mizuguchi-san. Went on these crazy adventures. He took us up into the mountains. I was with Dominic, my good buddy, one of my best friends from lobotomy. And, we went up there and, you know, and he hung out and showed us the world and took us to this crazy trance party and saw all the psychedelic music and stuff that he was inspired by. It was my first experience to sort of psychedelic trance culture and this kind of like hippie trance culture in Japan. Needless to say, that weekend completely, you know, blew my mind. And he took us in and he was just building what would become United Game Artists. It was called CS4 at the time. So it's like the fourth group of the consumer software division, which is separate than the AM division.
Right.
Anyways, they were just kind of building this team up and like he had just a handful of people in there and he's like, hey, you know, I remember you said you were a big Morimoto fan. Have you seen this stuff? He brought a couple of their videotapes and just put me in this room with a bunch of his other commercials and other weird stuff that he had done that I'd never heard of before seen. And the stuff was all just, you know, mind sickeningly, like my world just kind of exploded into this new dimension. It was like, you know, entering the Matrix or like there's no going back at this point. So, I begged and pleaded some more. We hung out some more. And then, you know, I went back to Seattle and a couple weeks later, he's like, all right, you know, let's do this thing. I was like, this is happening. Oh my God. And all my friends were like, dude, you're going to go work in a Japanese corporation. Like you speak like 10 words of Japanese. I was like, yeah, so what? Like he speaks English. It'll be fine. Like this is going to be great. Oh my God. Like, do you guys, I'm going to go work for the guy that makes Sega Rally. Like, are you kidding me? And everyone's just like, you're nuts. Like, you, what are you talking about? You're going to go work at a Japanese company. Like, you can't read, you can't write, you can't do anything. I was like, I don't care. It'll be fine. And then I got there and it was amazing. And it was, you know, this total meltdown from a fanboy standpoint to be like, you know, standing with these legends and like, you know, joining Sega Japan, this new division. And we were right in the heart of Shibuya, which was, you know, most of the the CS and the AM stuff was all down in Haneda, which is just like industrial town, super boring. There's only a handful of restaurants. It's just not a cool place to work. No offense, Sega friends, but it is not an exciting neighborhood to be placed in. It is a very industrial sort of area. We were in the heart of the city, you know, kind of right around the youth culture. And where was I going with this? I get all wrapped up.
Shibuya.
Oh, anyways, he brings me in and I was like, when am I going to start? And he's like, yeah, you know, start as soon as you can. So they found an apartment for me and set me all up with the stuff. And I came in and, you know, it was like 30 people maybe. I was joining it was right before I joined the Space Channel 5 team. There was another project on the side that we were doing. I was on that team, but I met the whole team and like everybody comes up to me and they're just like shaking my hand, talking to me in Japanese. And it took me a couple minutes. And I was like, wow, I did fuck up, man. This is stupid. Like, what was I thinking? Like, I got so carried away by the idea of this whole thing. I didn't consider, you know, what it would mean to actually be working at a Japanese corporation where I don't speak or read or anything. And it was tough. It was really hard. I mean, people were so sweet and they were super, you know, patient with me. And I was trying to figure out, I had never used Softimage. We moved on to Softimage. I was an Alias user. And so you know, there was so much learning going on and I wasn't, you know, getting enough rest. We were working long hours and you know, I was just completely overwhelmed, but people were really gentle and sweet. And I'm still good friends with a bunch of those guys. And, you know, within a year or so, I learned to speak decent Japanese just because I was so immersed in it.
Right. Yeah. You didn't really have a choice.
Didn't have a choice. Like we'd have these big meetings. We'd have these big design meetings and talking about stuff. And I told Mizuguchi-san after a while, I was like, I don't have any point going to these meetings. I don't understand what they're talking about. I don't know what's going on. And he's just like, just come, just be a part of it. And so I would sit there and I would, you know, you would hear the same words over and over again. And so I would write down the words that I just kept. I was able to kind of start pulling out of this, you know, this jumble of words. And then after the meetings, I'd be like, what's this? What's this? You know, my friends, I would be like, what does this word mean? What does this word mean? And so it was a really good way to kind of build up your phonetic system from the ground up. Like the stuff that gets said the most is the stuff that you start using the most and, you know, kind of really built a really natural sort of foundation to base my skills on. So my spoken Japanese has gotten pretty good. I still don't read very well, but I just never had time to do that. I'm reading a lot of manga lately, so I'm finally kind of up at my skills, which is funny because I have a lot of friends that come over here from the States that like study Japanese in college and they read thousands of kanji and they're like all this stuff, but then they can't really like hold a conversation.
I can read it a lot better than I can understand it or speak it.
Yeah, which is funny because I literally still, I just, you know, even like my kids read Doraemon and I'm like reading that. I'm like, I can read this. This is great. I'm flying through that. But I'm reading Dragon Ball now and I have to like have my Google Translate, you know, kind of like, but it's a great way to learn. I'm learning new stuff and new vocabulary that way too. But anyways, yeah, I got the job at Sega and that was, you know, I was there for 4.5 years and probably some of the best years of my life. I mean, I was young, I was hungry. I was super excited to be there. We were working on some of the coolest stuff in the world, you know, from Space Channel 5. And then moving on to Res was, you know, that was kind of the reason I went there. And it was kind of like in a real slow burn kind of pre-production thing where they were trying to figure out just what they were doing. It was just a handful of guys. And so while they were kind of just prototyping the very early, the broad strokes, I was on the Space Channel 5 team doing character design animation, mostly animation and modeling, stuff like that. Then I finally got into the Res team. And it was just like, wow, this is something.
Right. Res was pretty much what landed you to the job, even though it didn't exist at that point.
Yeah.
And it's crazy that you just, you know, like this chain of events happened and you just happened to be on the same wavelength about what you wanted to create as Mizuguchi. Like,
yeah, I mean, just,
it's
wild. Was uncanny. I mean, I really, the fact that I called out this animator and was so, you know, moved by this like 3 minute piece of animation that, you know, I really literally was like, I want to build something like this. And
that is a hell of a scene though.
Oh God, it still is. It still just gives me chills every time.
Yeah. I keep, you know, every once in a while I'll do a search. I'm like, has that come out on Blu-ray yet? No. I want to see that, you know, I want to watch it again, but I want to watch it in like high res, not on DVD. I had the VHS tapes.
So, I mean, that was a, you know, a massive period, obviously, of inspiration and influence in my life, working on that. And to make matters even worse, before I got the job at Sega, I had applied to Team Andromeda. I loved Panzer Dragoon. I was such a Panzer Dragoon fan. And I had a Japanese friend of mine that I had gone to school with in Kobe here who moved to Seattle to join the same community college. And I was like, please help me fill out this Japanese resume. I'm going to apply. I want to work at Team Andromeda. And so I sent off the resume, everything formal by the book, you know, the picture and the resume and like all this stuff. And I never heard back. So years later, fast forward to working at Sega, and it turned out a big chunk of the Space Channel 5 team and the Res team was ex-Panzer Dragoon people. Mm-hmm. After the Team Andromeda sort of split up, and a bunch of those team went to Mizuguchi-san's new group. In fact, most of the Sega employees that had come over were from that group. There was that group and then the AM transition. So the guys that had done the Sega Rally Saturn port, some of those guys came over too. And so I didn't realize it at first, but after a while, like somebody had something lying around. I was like, what's that? And like I realized all of a sudden that these were the Panzer Dragoon people. Like it was the Panzer Dragoon Saga team that was making up Space mm-hmm. Channel 5 and the Res team. At which point I flipped out again and was like, oh my God, you know, this is crazy. And so Yokota-san, who became the art director on Res, he had literally done all of Saga's cover art and all this stuff. In fact, yesterday I bought the limited edition record from Soundwave, Brainwave,
yeah.
And got Kobayashi-san to sign it. And like I've known her for years and just was like, oh, this is like seriously one of the best albums ever. And seeing all Yokota-san's paintings, they did a really beautiful job with that. Like this big, you know, the whole book. In fact, I had it. I ran upstairs this morning. I might put it up on my wall of fame up there. But just, you know, working with those people in that whole time was just crazy. I knew how lucky I was too. Like I really did. I knew that this was a one in a million chance, and you know, to have these opportunities and work with these people and learn this stuff. And they're still my dear friends. Just yesterday, I was hanging out with Hota-san and Matsuzaki-san, who were the two of the other lead artists that were kind of my senpais that sat right next to me. Just stunning design chops, unbelievable design skills and drawing skills and everything. And I had come from an animation background, so I could like draw.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked drawing characters, but I wasn't a designer. I wasn't right. I didn't have a process to like, you know, define the equation and kind of like try to come up with a solution to solve a specific problem. I didn't think that way at all. And these guys kind of started to beat that stuff into me. And I was just like, wow, they're so good. Like I'll never be as good as these guys. They're just like animals off the board. I mean, Yokota-san, the lead artist, was just like a machine, you know, just like skills beyond like anything I'd seen at any of the American studios that I'd experienced at all. And so years later, you know, kind of about once UGA kind of started to fall apart, we got sort of absorbed by Sonic Team.
Mm.
And Mizuguchi-san was going to quit. And I was the first one to kind of leave the ship. What it was starting to disintegrate. Some of the key guys peeled off and, you know, stuff started to kind of go away. And so that's when I left and decided to go back to design school. And so that's when I went to Art Center in Pasadena. After about 4.5 years at Sega, and it was heartbreaking to leave, but I was tired. Tokyo had, you know, I partied hard and it took my toll. It took its toll on me. And I knew that, you know, working at a big Japanese corporation like that, like the ceiling was going to be up there at some point. Like I was going to have to do something else to be able to kind of, like, I didn't really want to move into management, but at a big company like that, it's a very defined track.
Yeah.
You know, and I was like, to get into management and stuff, I'd have to really be able to read and write and email and do all this stuff. And so it was heartbreaking, but I decided to go back and go to school, always knowing that I would come back to Japan someday. Like I was so hooked on it that, you know, it was always kind of in my back pocket. It was like this plan, like to find a way back here at some point.
So what was your way back?
Well, I wanted to come back right after art school, right after Art Center. I was like, okay, I'm going to find a way. You know, I was talking to Mizuguchi-san. He'd started up,
Q
Entertainment. And so I was, you know, talking to him and talking to people. Sega at the time, I got the job at EA in Los Angeles. So I was working with Steven Spielberg and that crew on the LMNO project, which never shipped. And I was a concept artist. And EA was publishing, oh God, I'm spacing the name. It was a horror game done by Grasshopper. Boy, about 2005.
Totally blanking out, but yeah.
I know the game. I'm totally spacing it. Regardless, I was like, wow, maybe I could get a job with this EA Los Angeles paycheck, but I could go back to Tokyo. Like, how could I work that? So I met through Utsumi-san, who had been the head of sort of Sega production, who's Mizuguchi-san's boss when I was at Sega. He was friends with these guys, and so he introduced me to Suda-san. And so I interviewed there and kind of talked to those guys about trying to get a job there. And didn't really work out. And then kind of really wanted to find a way to keep my salary from the West Coast in Japan, which was challenging. I had talked to Dylan about maybe coming over at Q Games here in Kyoto. Dylan was an old friend of mine. I had met him through the Tokyo circuit, the TGS circuit, while I was at Sega there. He was at Sony in Japan at the time in Tokyo. So I kind of wandered for a while. I was like, what am I going to do? And then, we got pregnant with our first son and, we were living on the beach in Santa Monica, and with two, you know, single, a married couple with no children, dinks.
Yeah.
That was a sustainable lifestyle. But when she was going to go offline to have a child, we decided that was probably not going to be sustainable anymore. So came to Seattle and joined my old friend Mark Long at Zombie, where I went on to art director as, on Blacklight Tango Down was a game we were working on at the time. But I'd been doing kind of hardcore sci-fi concept art for a couple of years at that point. And I was kind of like, not over it, but I was like wanting to spread my wings in a different direction. And I really wanted to do something kind of cute and minimal, get back to my animation style roots. And now with a design background that I'd picked up at Art Center and at EA, kind of wanted to do something cute and simple. And so I talked to my friend Baruch Pfeiffer, who had been an AI programmer on the Elemento project. It was kind of starting to fall apart at the time. He had left. And we kind of made this dumb decision to make a little indie studio and do this kind of little strategy game on the side while I kept my day job. And it kind of went really well, and he was a really good programmer, and we just sort of, it sort of became its own thing. And at some point I was like, this could be a thing. And so I quit Zombie, and we started up what we became Haunted Temple Studios and started up Skulls of the Shogun, and sort of, I was working from home. He was working from home. I was like, this is great. I can just kind of slide back into Japan. My wife is Japanese. I could just like go back to Japan, and I could just keep doing this little indie lifestyle from there. But as the project went on, we weren't ready to go yet. More staff started coming on. Pretty soon I had some staff in Seattle, and it just kind of got roots, and it got a lot harder to sort of be mobile. So we sort of wrapped up Skulls and then moved on to Galaxy, and I was getting antsy. I was like, I got to get back to Japan. I got to figure this out. But now we have like a whole studio here. What did I do? So whenever we hired somebody else, I was like, listen, we're moving to Japan. You're in or you're out. Like, tell me now. Like, I don't want you to be surprised later, you know, in a year from now when I say, hey, we're going to uproot this entire thing and we're going to move to Japan. Everyone was like, what? I'm like, it's going to be fun. Come on. It'll be great. And so it took a lot longer to sort of make the migration over here than I thought it would. But we finally did. And not as many guys as I'd hoped would came over. So we still have the Seattle guys. Mm-hmm. So they this new studio we have here, like, you know, showing you this morning, is a kind of an old architecture studio. It's a house, basically.
Right.
And so we have a full guest room and stuff. So the Seattle guys come out. We have like one of them in rotation at any given time, which works. It's nice. And we do have a West Coast presence, which is nice. And in the summertime, I generally go back and work out at the Seattle office when it's really hot here and my kids are on break and I stay with my folks. And I have friends that come stay at my house here. So it works out. But that's, yeah, I mean, just all this stuff afterwards was kind of just tumbled into place through these random series of events. And I knew I wanted to go back to Japan. I knew that was going to happen. And, I actually really wanted to go back to Tokyo. You know, I had so many friends there and I had such a great time with the Sega people, and all that crew was still up there doing fun stuff. A lot of them had spun off and started their own studios and everybody's doing cool stuff. So I really wanted to go back. My wife is from Tokyo. She was like, no way, we're going to have kids. I don't want to live in the big city. She wanted to move out to the countryside, like out in the middle of nowhere somewhere. I'm like, I'm kind of a city boy. Like, I love nature, but I need culture. And so we kind of just couldn't figure out what to do for a long time. We just kind of stayed put in Seattle. And then we, on a whim, you know, I'd been talking to Dylan for years, and he's like, Kyoto, 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 trust me, Kyoto, Kyoto, Kyoto. And so we came to check out Kyoto, and we spent 2 weeks here in, it must have been 2010, maybe 2009, 2010. No, wait, 2011. 2011 or 2012 was my second son, was a little baby. And we came here and we both just totally fell in love with it, because it's like, it's the ultimate mix. It's like nature and traditional culture and like this low paced, you know, lifestyle. And, you know, it's affordable and it's cheap and it's all the things, like a lot of the benefits of living in the countryside. Mm. But at the same time, it's a world-class city with amazing dining, amazing music and culture.
Kyoto's really fascinating because it is this kind of like blend of country and city. Like I interviewed Mizuguchi at his hotel, the Four Seasons is where he was staying. And, you know, I think Four Seasons, I think like 20 stories tall and like concrete and steel, but no, it's like four stories high and it's all wood on the outside and it's kind of secluded and back and away from the street. Like, I actually had trouble finding it because Google Maps like sent me up the wrong side street, and I ended up like walking through the front gates of a girl's high school as students were coming in. And I was like, I just stopped and I was like, hey, faculty folks, I'm in the wrong place. And turned around and left, and they all laughed. But like, you know, that's just kind of Kyoto. Like every side street you go up, its residences, but then also they're in, you know, like just tucked away with everything. There's always like a noodle shop or like a little izakaya or, you know, like a place that sells giant stuffed animals down the block from here. It's like, it's yeah, just like everything all mashed in, and it doesn't feel manic in the same way that Tokyo's mash of stuff feels.
It took me a while. I think it was about a month into being here. I was riding my bike down to the computer store. It's not far south of here. And it dawned on me, like, wow, no one's in a hurry here. No one is in a hurry here. Like, you know, used to Tokyo and Shibuya, like, there's just this, you, like, you notice yourself walking faster. Like, everything's just intense. And you go into the next meeting and people are running around. And, like, it's this manic and frantic intensity, which is dopamine. I mean, it's completely like addictive and amazing. But coming here, I was just like, literally, like the red lights are forever, and everyone's just kind of like, you look around, like no one's in a hurry, like no one cares. They like stop at the red light and read their phone and hang out. And I was just like, this is a. I could tell like immediately. It was like I knew I may not be suited to Tokyo for like the long term. Like even with the family and stuff, like that intensity all the time is like, again, it's one of the most addictive drugs in the universe, but it is draining. And so coming here, I was like, wow, I could live here forever, I think. And I can go to Tokyo whenever I want. I can go to Osaka in one train stop. And, like, mm-hmm. I'm down to Umeda on one single line. I was like, how do you beat this place? I mean, I don't like the summer heat, that's for sure.
Yeah.
But just in terms of a lifestyle city. And it's funny because – and I talk to people all the time. People come to Kyoto and they love it. They fall in love with it. They're like, oh, my God, Kyoto's so beautiful. And they go to the temples and they do the kind of sites and stuff. And they're like, oh, Kyoto. And the reality is – when you live here, that stuff is, it's on the back platter, and you can go, you know, run off to some beautiful temple whenever you want to. But really, as a lifestyle city, it's almost unbeatable. Like, I ride my bike to work. Everything's super chill. You have your little mom and pop owned shops and restaurants. And I have like my daily bread shop. I have my bike shop. I ride by my, you know, my realtor who helped us with this place. And like, it's like you're saying good morning to everybody. And there's like this sense of society and just kind of like calmness and like place in the city. Like, I've never felt this sense of like, I am a piece of this society, and like I interact with all these people on a regular basis. And I guess part of it's the bike lifestyle, but also like everybody that I know in the city kind of lives in the same kind of west or the east side of the city over here near the river. Mm. And the main thoroughfare is the path going up and down the river. So daily you bump into friends, you just see friends all the time. And so like Q Games is right down the street and Vitae is just kind of right past them. The Skeleton Crew guys are here and like, you know, Nintendo friends. I got a lot of friends that work at Nintendo. And so you just tend to bump into people while you're out and about. And, you know, it really struck me, like, as an American, even in Shibuya, like, you know, you bump into people, but it's not quite the same in Tokyo. Mm. But, you know, in the States, you get in your car and you drive to work. And, you know, I mean, San Francisco, I think, is different. And a lot more people take the mass transit stuff. But, like, I'm from Seattle. We don't have mass transit there. We have, you know, kind of a half-assed bus system. And so you just are living in these bubbles. You don't really co-opt with other people like nearly at the same frequency. Like you might have your barista at Starbucks that you see every morning, but that's about, you know, the kind of the extent of it. At least that was my experience. And so coming here, you're just like, wow, like this is like life on a different scale. And there's just so much history and culture here. It's not a big city, but you could never see it all. You could never do it all. Every, like you said, every street, I'm like, oh, I've never been on the street before. Like it's only two streets down and a couple streets over. And there's like 10 new restaurants that look amazing and like some weird little boutique and some cool little shop. And you're like, wow, like it never ends. And there's no, I think there is zoning here, but it's not the same way that we zone where it's like kind of strict. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, there's a little tiny burrito shop tucked behind, you know, this haircut place, which is right next to a bunch of homes. And there's no real order, no discernible order. I don't know how these things kind of are just arrayed around the city. But it's, again, it's its own thing, and it's completely addictive, and I never get tired of it. And just walking around Kyoto, you can't help but just kind of have a smile on your face. You're like, wow, it's just so lovely here. It's just so quiet and kind of happy. And like, when you live here, everybody you know loves Japan. They come to Japan, and they go to Tokyo, and they come to Kyoto. So, like, I mean, almost every week we've got friends in town. I'm like, cool. I don't have to do anything. Let's go to dinner. Let's go to lunch, whatever. This weekend was a, you know, great example of that. Probably a little too much. I have too many friends in town this week, and I'm not going to be able to see them all. But Bit Summit has become this, you know, this piece of the culture here. Mm. And it's awesome to have it. Getting known more and more as a game developing sort of hub, but just having all these cool people kind of coming here on a regular basis and having their own favorite restaurants. Like I'm learning about cool new restaurants from, you know, friends from Sony and stuff like that. And they're spending enough time here now that they're finding stuff that I don't know. And it's all just kind of coming full circle. So.
Well, this has been your Kyoto civic promotion. Chamber of Commerce thanks you for listening to this episode of Retronauts. but it is a great city, and there is a lot of game development here, and you know, like a lot of people with deep roots. I guess it makes sense. You know, you've got Nintendo here, and you have just over in Osaka, you have companies like SNK and Capcom been around forever. So,
and there's a lot of smaller studios in Osaka. Yeah, too. There's a lot of stuff going on these days.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, a lot of studios kind of form from people that trickle out of those companies and put up new roots. And yeah, it's great. I mean, I feel like there is a real vital game development scene here. It's cool that you've managed to kind of carve a niche for yourself, and you're making games that, you know, like I look at Skulls of the Shogun and Galaxy, and those really combine a lot of Western and Japanese influences in a pretty unique way. You know, Galaxy is like so Macross, but at the same time, it's also kind of like a roguelike shooter. So it's like putting together a whole lot of things. And I can definitely see that you grew up liking a lot of the same things that I did. And so I, you know, a game like that, I'm like, yeah, that's a really awesome, but it really kind of stands out.
Thank you. Yeah. I mean, that era, that 8 and 16-bit era of the Japanese stuff, that's the mold that I'm, you know, cut from in terms of the gameplay, you know. And then older as you become a developer, like, you know, I had a really good experience working, you know, both a bunch in Japan and kind of really understanding the Japanese approach to design and sort of, you know, game making, which is quite different than the West, but also spending, you know, enough time in the West to kind of see all their methodologies and processes and stuff. And they very much have different strengths and weaknesses. You know, they're very different sort of schools of thought, I think. And so it was a real joy for me to be able to kind of pull stuff from both sides of that and you know, put together my inspirations of, you know, like the kind of more Western style gameplay on a modern front, kind of merged with this classic old school genres and stuff like that. So I think that, I mean, that's kind of what 17-bit, you know, stands for. It's like the 16-bit era plus a bit more, you know, plus a bit of like of the new kind of merged on top of these classic concepts. And I think it's a formula that's worked well for us. And I really love being able to, you know, stretch our wings in ways that haven't been done before, like trying to take new chances and new risks and just kind of readdressing ways that, you know, technology has improved and some things I feel like can be progressed. And people, you know, tend to get into a rut of like, well, this is the way things are done. Like, this is how this has always been handled. Like, I'm stupid enough to be like, well, what if we totally threw that all out and cooked up something different, which costs time and money and everything. But, you know, at the end of the day, you get these cool different types of experiences, which is what I think. I feel like if, and I don't mean to sound like snobby or anything here, but I feel like if you're doing everything the way that it's always been done, you're doing it wrong. I feel like there's been enough of the same thing, and it's time to sort of embrace these new technologies and take stuff, you know, a bit into the next dimension. So our next title is very completely off the rails of everything we've ever done before, and it's its own entity, and it's very, I think it's going to be very progressive.
And you said you'll be showing that off for the first time next year, 2019?
Probably, yeah. Probably no sooner than that. It's pretty early. We've assembled a pretty amazing crew of insane veterans here that are all, you know, in Kyoto for the right reasons and building something very special. So I'm very excited about kind of sharing that with the world and stuff and kind of introducing the team, but the time is still early. So,
All right. Well, we will wrap here because I know you've probably got a busy day ahead of you, catching up after Bitsummit and so forth. But I do want to ask, you know, as one final question, you have, I think, a pretty unique perspective on the Japanese gamers industry, having been an insider and an outsider, you know, someone who's spent time with some of the big studios here and has started your own business here and knows a lot of people here, but also who, you know, spent a lot of time working in the US. So, you know, kind of from that perspective, what do you think is your prognosis for the health of the Japanese games industry, like for its future? You know, a few years ago, you asked someone that question and they were like, it's not looking good, but, you know, I feel like, if you just look at Tokyo Game Show, you're going to be like, yeah, maybe there's some problems. It's not going so great. But then you look at BitSummit and I don't know, like maybe I'm leading the question here, the answer, but I feel like you're seeing a whole new avenue of creativity in Japan that wasn't here, you know, 5 years ago. And it's, to me, it's encouraging. I'm just curious if you think that's, you know, like naive.
I think it's an interesting time. I think there was definitely a darker area before this where people were like the Japanese stuff was kind of, I think, technologically a little bit behind. And, you know, most decisions were being made by the big corporate companies, you know, big games. needing to play it safe for financial reasons and stuff like that. Japanese do love their sequels and their big series and stuff like that. So, you know, that's always going to be a big thing. I do think that some of that demand is diminished in the West. I don't think, you know, Final Fantasy or things like that have as much weight as they once did. Those names don't mean what they once did. My biggest concern with the Japanese market is this sort of the Galapagos mentality of, like, you know, they really cater to their own market. Mm-hmm. You know, the Japanese love Japanese games. Always have, probably always will. I mean, I think there's more Western games now than there ever has been before. And that's definitely trending in the right direction. Mm-hmm. There is more outside influences coming in. And BitSummit's a cool part of that. But I feel like, especially with the mobile market, like, it's so hyper-focused on the Japanese market that that has become this huge moneymaker here. Like, it is huge. Mobile games are huge in Japan. And a lot of that stuff is just not really culturally, like, appropriate. Not that it's inappropriate, but it's just not really, like, targeted towards Western audiences. And a lot of this stuff kind of comes and goes, and there's no archiving of these free-to-play titles, like these mobile titles and stuff like that. You can't just, like, build a ROM and, like, put it on the internet for people to download and play 10 years from now. So, like, I feel like a lot of the culture and the history of the games of this era is going to be sort of only viewable through, you know, YouTube and stuff like that. So that stuff actually really freaks me out. It really kind of worries me. That being said, I do think the console market is sort of, you know, enjoying a bit of a rebirth. I think there's a lot of there was kind of a generation where, like, all the big hotshot game honchos sort of disappeared and quit, and, like, you know, people leaving Konami or Sega or whatever, you know, like, I mean, we all know the names, and everybody's been through this a million times. But some of these guys are starting to kind of come back up and having their own studios and doing stuff and kind of getting outside of the molds and doing some experiencing, you know, some new ideas. And I think it's definitely trending well. I think they're, you know, the Japanese definitely have their own spin on game design. But I think a lot of that stuff is kind of reintroducing itself to the West. And I mean, by the West, I mean the rest of the world, really. But there's, you know, it's on a rebound, I feel like, is the short story. I love seeing the Japanese indie stuff, you know, kind of coming up finally. Like, they were definitely quite behind for a long time. And, you know, you go to BitSummit, and it's still, the vast majority of them are foreigners that come from other places, you know.
But there are
more and more Japanese games.
Year to year from last year, there's a lot more Japanese indie stuff at BitSummit.
A lot more Japanese indie stuff. I think the Switch has been a blessing. I think that you're seeing a lot of stuff coming to Switch, and you're seeing a lot of smaller Japanese teams going, hey, let's take some chances. Let's do something a little funky and original. At a smaller scale, the digital thing takes a lot of risk out of it. It takes a lot of the cost out of, you know, needing the publisher and the whole kind of traditional system. I mean, Japan is still very retail-based. You know, like, everything is driven around the retail presence and stuff like that. So it's hard to do that with the digital stuff. But, you know, they do. You see the download codes and the mini-marts and stuff like that. But I do think that, you know, the Japanese stuff is kind of rebounding. It's going on a better trajectory than I probably would have thought a couple of years ago. And so that makes me very happy. I mean, this is my home now. And, you know, a lot of these people have become my favorite people and creators and stuff like that. And so seeing people kind of getting off the rails and doing some unique, fun, interesting stuff and having the financial wherewithal to do so is really encouraging. So, yeah, it's a good time. It's fun to be back. And I love seeing where things are going. And, you know, I have enough friends in high places now that I get to see cool stuff before it's coming out. And, you know, it's definitely all trending in the right direction, which is something I wasn't sure was going to happen a couple of years ago. So I guess, you know, the short version is I'm happy that things are going well.
Cool. All right. Well, thank you very much for your time. Do you want to tell everyone where they can find you on the internet and maybe buy your products if they're so inclined?
Please do. 17_bit on Twitter is the studio. I'm at Jkooza, Jkooza. 17bit.com is our webpage. It hasn't been updated a whole lot lately. We do have some big announcements coming soon. We have some big releases coming out very soon. Expect to see us at E3. There's some cool stuff coming. Those are the short versions. Yeah, I'm on Instagram, Jkooza, as well. I take a lot of pictures of games and retro games and stuff. I spend a lot of time in the old game shops. So I have a big collection of stuff that gets me excited in here, because there's a never-ending batch of cool old box art and stuff like that that I've never seen before. So, yeah, my Instagram account is probably the place to go for that kind of stuff.
All right, and you can find me on Twitter as GameSpite and Retronauts as Retronauts, and at Retronauts.com, which is where I write all the time. Retronauts is also on iTunes, and it's on Podcast One, so listen to us, download us, etc. We're supported through Patreon, patreon.com/Retronauts. You get early access, high bit rate, no ads. It's cool. It's great. $3 a month. It's a deal. Wow. Anyway, so I'm going to head back to America soon because I'm really loopy from jet lag, as you can tell. But thank you, Jake. It was great talking to you, and really fascinating to hear all these anecdotes about the like your kind of entree into the games industry through, you know, like the game counselor stuff is stuff that I viewed as an outsider and was like, wow, these people must know a lot about video games. So it was really a cool discussion. So thanks again.
My pleasure. Very much. Thank you very much.
Capital One Quicksilver Card, you earn unlimited 1.5% cash back on every purchase everywhere. It's easy. That's just the way I like it.
Oh, that's the way, I like it, That's the way, I like it,
Woo! The Quicksilver Card from Capital One. What's in your wallet?
That's the way,
Capital One Bank, USANA.
The Mueller Report. I'm Ed Donahue with an AP News Minute. President Trump was asked at the White House if Special Counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigation report should be released next week when he will be out of town.
I guess from what I understand, that will be totally up to the Attorney General.
Maine's Susan Collins says she would vote for a congressional resolution disapproving of President Trump's emergency declaration to build a border wall, becoming the first Republican senator to publicly back it. In New York, the wounded supervisor of a police detective killed by friendly fire was among the mourners attending his funeral. Detective Brian Simonson was killed as officers started shooting at a robbery suspect last week. Commissioner James O'Neill was among the speakers today at Simonson's funeral.
It's a tremendous weight to bear, knowing that your choices will directly affect the lives of others. But cops like Brian don't shy away from it. It's the very foundation of who they are and what they do.
The robbery suspect and a man police say acted as his lookout have been charged with murder. I'm Ed Donahue.